For the week of April 8th, 2018, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 406, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz.
Birmingham, Alabama. How are you doing, Michael? You really do get around.
Well, I'm about to get on the road again. I'm headed to Atlanta and then back to New York City. Just in time to see a new adaptation, a new musical version of The Sting starring Harry Connick Jr.
Oh, really? I've actually seen Harry Connick Jr. on Broadway, and he was very good. Of course, he's a musician, so he should be.
Yes, and you had a week off. How was your vacation?
It was very good. I was in Seattle, where I actually stopped by the Sub Pop record store. Sub Pop being a record label from Seattle, kind of an indie label that made it big with bands like Nirvana and others, and stopped by their store. Guess where it was, Michael?
Where?
It was at the airport. It's at SeaTac. There's no record store in Seattle, but, you know, at SeaTac, you can go to the record store.
There's no record store in Seattle?
Okay, I'm exaggerating. There are a few record stores in Seattle, but Easy Street Records in Queen Anne closed, and now they're only in West Seattle, their original location.
Record stores are gone all over the country, and you were gone last week, but will you be gone next week? Is there a show next week?
Oh, yes, there is. Thank you for actually reminding me. Speaking of music, I will be at Coachella, so we haven't talked about this, Michael, so we're doing it right in here. We will have to record on a Tuesday.
All right. So we'll be recording, so people can look for that Tuesday night.
Yes, correct.
Tuesday the 17th rather than on Monday or Tuesday. So, okay.
Right. Or as it's known here in the United States this year, tax day.
All right. So that's what's happening next week. We know what happened last week. What's going to happen this week on the show?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we are playing catch up after a 1 week break, as you just mentioned, Michael. China and the U.S. have started a trade war. You know, I can't even leave for a week. Director Steven Spielberg is back in the blockbuster game, and the worldwide box office set a new record in 2017. Is that enough to make Hollywood calm down after North America hit a 22-year low in ticket sales? Probably not. In other big news, MoviePass ended its boycott of AMC's most popular LA locations and snapped up MoviePhone. Wait, MoviePhone is still a thing?
If you think MoviePhone is still a thing, press one.
Spotify went public, and we look at the numbers. Do record labels with a piece of the company now have an incentive to give Spotify better terms? And where does that leave artists? I think about $250 million poorer if you are an artist on Sony Records or Sony Music. In sexual misconduct, the head of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences has been cleared by an internal investigation. The people that hand out the Nobel Prize in Literature have their own scandal, and Nickelodeon parted ways with the network's biggest producer. On Inside Baseball, we discussed the Justice Department possibly spotlighting the ticket agency Live Nation, or Ticketmaster, which is owned by Live Nation, and its stranglehold on the concert-going market. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office, and this week, he's got something scary for us.
There's a lot to talk about at the worldwide box office. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes, and the number one movie around the world. It opened last weekend, so-so in the U.S., stronger overseas. It's Steven Spielberg's Ready Player One. It made $106 million this weekend. It's at just under $400 million worldwide. That's what it needs to do, since it needs to gross about $520 million to be in the black, at least in terms of a box office hit. It was a big budget film from Steven Spielberg. It's been a long time since he's made big blockbuster type movies. This is the biggest budget he's played with in quite a while, and it's turned into a decent, solid success story. Looks like it's going to do well enough around the world, especially China, to make back its money. If North America was the only market, he'd be in a lot of trouble.
Well, so do we know the budget on this film? $175 million. Okay, so
that's right. And we believe that worldwide, 60% of the box office gross has come from 3D ticket sales.
Yeah, and I would say about 66 of that, 66 million came from Real D, which of course being the, it's the predominant player now in 3D.
So that's the big movie around the world. It had a decent start last weekend. It's held well overseas, so it's doing quite well in China and other countries. So that's at $400 million. It's been a long time, like I said, since Spielberg has played this game. In the last 10, 15 years, he's been making modestly budgeted films that aren't geared towards making that big amount of money. In fact, The last time he directed a popcorn flick was Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. That was a decade ago.
Well, what about the one he did with Peter Jackson, the Tintin?
Tintin. That Peter Jackson directed that, or did he direct that?
I thought it was like co-directed.
They were alternating, actually.
Oh, you're right. And I think he did direct that one, and it was his first digital film.
Oh, you're right. I'm sorry. The 2011 was the last time he directed a big budget movie. He got confused with that whole Tintin thing. Before that was Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. It's been a long time since he's had to make a movie that had to make this much money. It needs to gross $525 million, and it looks like it'll do that.
Yeah, and it's gotten good reviews.
No, it's gotten okay reviews.
Okay, well, the last time I...
It hasn't gotten good reviews. It got okay reviews. Were you looking at the Rotten Tomatoes number?
No, just the reviews I've read.
Yeah, no, nobody's saying it's a great film. Not one person has said, what a great film. That's not good reviews.
Wasn't necessarily a great book either.
Well, no, it's not a good book, but anyway. And number two around the world is a horror flick. It's A Quiet Place. $71 million on its opening weekend. This for a movie that cost $17 million to make. It was directed by John Krasinski of The Office. It stars John and his wife, Emily Blunt, about people in a slightly near future time when aliens have attacked the Earth and they are blind and they can only track you down if you make noise. So everyone must live in complete silence.
You know, what Ricky Gervais would say about your last sentence is actually Jonathan Krasinski of The Office from America.
Fair enough. What I like about this movie, and I would have said this before the opening weekend, is that it has about 3 minutes of dialogue.
Yes.
The entire film is quiet. And to my mind, that says that's a movie that can play really, really well around the world. You don't need to speak English. You don't need to read subtitles. You don't even need to be literate in order to enjoy this film. And that's, I think, is a really powerful thing. We saw Koyaanisqatsi many decades ago become a surprise art house hit all over the world because it played everywhere. Anybody could watch it and appreciate it. There was no dialogue. That's why big Hollywood spectacles work. And that's why this horror film is going to travel really, really well.
Yeah, you know, I had it pegged to do $25 million over at Celluloid Junkie. I predicted a $25 million opening. And that was because I didn't think it could beat Get Out, which was another kind of festival favorite horror film. I thought, well, can it go past Get Out? I don't know. Maybe, but I'll try and underestimate it. So I did 25 million. I underestimated it by half.
100%. No, 100%.
Oh, 100%. But I think even the tracking on it did not have it at $50 million in North America.
But again, the tracking can only measure, you know, as soon as it was seen on Thursday, people loved it. It had great reviews in advance, good buzz by South by Southwest. Audiences loved it. And it's a movie you're not going to enjoy if you watch it at home alone. Not as much fun as seeing it in a big theater with everybody tense and quiet around you. So right from Thursday, Friday, the word of mouth was electric. And people went out and the movie did great. Some of the reviews said A Quiet Place was crushing Blockers and crushing Ready Player One in North America. That's not the way to see it. There have been a lot of winners this week. A Quiet Place was one, and Blockers is another one. This is the broad R-rated comedy, grossed $24 million on the first few days. It's at $32 million worldwide since opening on Thursday. And it's directed by Kay Cannon, a woman, one of the few women to direct an R-rated comedy. She produced Pitch Perfect. She wrote for 30 Rock. And now she's made her directorial debut, and it's a success out of the box.
Well, you know, that's great news for women directors. And by the way, for A Quiet Place, that's really good news for Paramount. That was the other reason I picked it at 25. I thought, really, I don't know if they've mounted a good enough marketing campaign. I kind of forgot that they had the Super Bowl commercial.
And it's been a long time since Paramount had a hit that they can be really excited by. I don't know. What's the sequel? Where you have to make a lot of noise to avoid the alien?
I don't know. That's a good question.
Up next is Peter Rabbit at number four. That grossed $20 million on the weekend. That's at $275 million worldwide. Another hit film. One that isn't going to be a hit probably is Pacific Rim Uprising. That made $17 million on the weekend. It's at $270 million worldwide. It seems to be slowing down all over the world, certainly in China. It has one market left. I think is it Japan for Pacific Rim Uprising, or is that for Ready Player One? I can't remember anymore, but it's mostly played out. I don't think it's going to get to $450 million, so I'm sure we will not see a Pacific Rim 3.
Which a lot of people were surprised that you saw a Pacific Rim 2.
Absolutely. We'll certainly see on the sequel to Black Panther, still making news, $13 million on the weekend. $1.3 billion worldwide. It became the third highest grossing film in North American history. It passed Titanic, beautiful little Leonardo DiCaprio and lovely Kate Winslet, passed up by Black Panther here in North America to be the third highest grossing film in box office history. Worldwide, it's the 10th highest grossing film of all time. Of course, that doesn't adjust for inflation, but when you do that in North America, it's the 34th highest grossing film of all time. That's huge. You think about The Sound of Music and Gone with the Wind and Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs and Jaws and E.T. There are a lot of huge iconic films, and Black Panther is ranked right up there with them. At number seven is an Indian film. It's called Hindi Medium. At first, I thought this was some light comedy about psychics, but no. This is a film that was a hit in India, and now it's been released in China. It grossed $11 million on the weekend. It's at $22 million worldwide. It's a drama, actually, about kids trying to get into an exclusive school rather than the Hindi medium school, which I guess is the more mediocre average school or the public school. It stars Irfan Khan and Pakistani actress Saba Kamar. It only cost $3.5 million to make, so that's a big success story. And number eight is the faith-based film, I Can Only Imagine, another $8 million. That's at $70 million and counting.
I couldn't imagine this film making $70 million.
It's in nine territories, and it's grossed about $1 million in all other eight territories. Oh, so wow. All of its money has come from North America. As of yet, this is a movie that they're not pushing hard into bigger markets or not going to try with. And number nine is Sherlock Gnomes. That's the Garden Gnome movie, animated flick, $8 million on the weekend, $45 million worldwide. That too will not be a success. But Tyler Perry's Acrimony, that's going to be just fine. This film stars Taraji P. Henson, correct?
Yes, it does.
Yes, $8 million on the weekend. It's at $32 million since it opened up last weekend. It only cost $20 million to make, so they're going to be just fine, I think. At number 11 is Tomb Raider, another hit. $6 million on the weekend. That's at $262 million. So it's just about to triple its reported budget.
Yeah, I guess it might be viewed as a not being a hit or not being successful because here in North America, it kind of fizzled. But the reality is, look, you spend $90 million making a product, right? And you then earn close to $270 million in 3 weeks. Not bad.
Right, not great. It made $55 million in North America, $210 million overseas. So that's where the money was.
Right.
But you make a movie for $90 million, you're playing the worldwide box office game. You're not expecting to make your money back in North America alone. You can't.
No, and let's put it this way. $262 million is where it's at right now. Let's say you only get back 50% of that, okay? You've just made $130 million. Start doing the math on that. You've made $40 million.
Plus your P&A, right?
Well, okay, fine. If you really want to get technical about it.
And number 12 is another film, Chappaquiddick. This is based on the Ted Kennedy scandal, if you prefer. It grossed $6.2 million on its opening weekend, and it comes from Byron Allen's Entertainment Studios, the blandly named powerhouse that we've just suddenly become aware of. So that's another film from them. And number 13 is Love, Simon. That's slowing down quite a bit. That's at $43 million worldwide. It's in six territories. We'll have to see if they open it up overseas. It's going to get to $50 million, though. It's going to be okay. And Wes Anderson's Isle of Dogs is slowly expanding. That's in two territories. It's grossed $18 million so far, and it has a long way to go. I'm looking forward to checking it out. And number 15 is a Korean horror flick. It's a found footage movie. It's called Gonjiam, Haunted Asylum. It grossed $4.8 million on the weekend. It's made $15 million since it opened last weekend. It only cost $2 million to make. And it's about a TV reality show that sends a group of kids into an abandoned psychiatric hospital late at night. Fun ensues.
Well, you know what? Isn't that called Saw?
Was that a psychiatric hospital?
I have no idea. I mean,
yeah, I never saw Saw.
No pun intended.
No, or no play on words or something.
Yeah.
At number 16 is another Indian film, Baghi 2. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that one. I apologize. That opened last weekend. It made $5 million on this weekend and is at $30 million and counting. It's a cheesy action flick, and it stars Tiger Shroff, a sort of Van Damme sort of star who has trouble keeping his shirt on, at least on the film poster. And they've already greenlit a sequel to this. So there will be a Baghi 3 or Baghi 3. However one says that. There will not be a sequel to Red Sparrow, even though it's the first part of a trilogy. The Jennifer Lawrence thriller is at $140 million worldwide. And number 18 is What a Man Wants. This is a Korean romantic comedy set on Jeju Island, aka the Island of Many Names. Because when you look it up, this island has been renamed like 1,000 times over the last 100, 200 years. But it's a tourist site. It has balmy weather year round. And it's a romantic tourist getaway place. And so it's a perfect setting for romantic comedy. That movie grossed $4.8 million on its opening weekend. Jumanji is still chugging along. That made $950 million worldwide. It will not get to the billion-dollar mark, but boy, it got close. Helen Hunt has a movie out. It's called The Miracle Season. It's another inspiring film. We couldn't figure out the budget. It grossed $4 million on its opening weekend.
I'll tell you, it's based on a true story about a volleyball team in Iowa, okay, that made it to the state championship after they lost their star player who died tragically and suddenly in a moped accident.
And they dedicated the rest of the season to her.
Yeah, but boy, does the trailer make this film look cheesy.
Yeah, no, the reviews have not been kind. I haven't read the reviews yet for The Snow Queen 3, Fire and Ice. This is a Russian animated film. It was supposed to be a Russian and Chinese animation film collaboration, but they couldn't even cooperate on a cartoon. It's grossed $20 million so far. And since the budget is reported $6 million, that's a hit. And I love this. Nothing to Lose is our film at number 22. It grossed $3.8 million this weekend. It's at about $12 million so far. It's a Brazilian film. Nada a Perder is Nothing to Lose, is the English translation. It's a biopic about the billionaire evangelical Agir Macedo. And this is a huge figure who's made all his money as a prosperity theology evangelical preacher. And there are reports in the Brazilian media that his churches have bought up stacks of tickets and gave them away. That's according to Bloomberg and local Brazilian coverage. The people have walked into empty theaters, even though they're supposed to be sold out. Some places noted that they went into theaters and the first four rows of every screening were sold out. The first four rows, which is an odd four rows to sell out immediately when the place is empty. And they'd go in, and despite the first four rows being sold out, there were only 10 people in the theater. So very suspicious. However, the Universal Church of the Kingdom of God, that's the church he founded, put out a press release before the movie was released and said, if anyone tells you we've bumped up these sales, they're liars. They had them sort of, and the movie has a perfect score on IMDb, a perfect 10, where The Godfather has a 9.2. So this is a crazy guy. He's 73 years old. He's a billionaire now. Mostly, it seems like, through his prosperity theology. They built a replica of the first temple that seats 10,000 people, and it costs $200 million. This movie only costs $7 million. He has the second largest TV network chain in Brazil. So he's a major, major powerhouse in that country. And his movie is playing to empty theaters, but successful box office. I love that story. 23 is Coco. That passed the $790 million mark. And at 24 is another Russian film, is Gogol V. I think we talked about this before. It's a Russian period thriller about the writer Nikolai Gogol, who can't sell a book. And he buys up copies of his books just to burn them because no one else will buy them. But he does have epileptic seizures, and those give him visions, and that helps him and a cop solve crimes.
You know what? This sounds like a CBS series.
Procedural. It sounds perfectly reasonable. It grossed $3.2 million on its opening weekend. So, if you know about a movie anywhere in the world that grossed more than $3 million, it should have been on our charts.
That's true.
So if you do, and it's not on our chart, and we didn't talk about it, let us know.
Yes, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. And please do call and do leave us a voicemail. I'm not being sarcastic, because it would be great to actually hear a human voice in between all of the fax machines that I'm listening to. you can follow us on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our handle. And you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox.
So we got some big news at the box office. The global annual box office hit a record. It passed the $40 billion mark, $40.6 billion worldwide, a new record. We're sure that will be topped next year, almost certainly. The North American market was $11.1 billion. That's down a little bit from the record high of 2016, which was $11.6 billion. It's only the third year in history where North American box office hit above $11 billion. But there is bad news as well, isn't there?
Well, yeah, U.S. attendance is, and this is what I've always said, Michael. You know, it's about attendance. It's been the lowest in 23 years in North America or in the United States.
That's right. But when you look at the whole pie, it's going great. And when you look at attendance overall, I don't think there's any reason to panic. I don't think there's any massive long-term trend here. It was just a down year. And that happens. You can't expect every year to set record attendance figures. And I think it's still within that range of our population and movie going and all that sort of stuff. If we see a 2 or 3 or 5 year trend of falling attendance, then you'll have something to talk about. But a 1 year drop, even a serious one, down to the lowest in 23 years, I don't think it's reason to hit the panic button.
Well, here's the way I look at it. If you look at, you know, any type of market, okay, it doesn't matter whether it's movies or it doesn't matter. Okay, this happens to be a market that is entertainment and leisure based. But if you look at Facebook, for instance, in the U.S. and in certain developed countries, they are kind of they've reached maturity level. They're not growing
Absolutely.
As quickly as, say, in territories where, you know, they're just coming online or internet access is just becoming available. And all of a sudden, you know, there's an explosion in growth for Facebook, as opposed to here, where the growth might be in the single digits per quarter. Well, guess what? You're talking about the same type of phenomenon here with movies. I'm not saying that it's a great thing that, you know, that the attendance has kind of leveled off or is growing at smaller rates. But, you know, it's not panic time yet. When it starts dipping really, really, you know, in double digits for extended periods of time, meaning years, then you can start worrying.
Yeah, movie going in North America has been a mature industry for decades. It's basically keeping pace with population growth. That's you know, inflation prices of ticket sales. That's what's going on. However, there are markets in the U.S. that you can target where Black people have historically punched above their weight, meaning they go to more movies than other people in other categories. And that's been reflected at the box office, how consistently you can make a lot of money when you make movies that appeal to them. Black Panther obviously appealed to everyone, but that's obviously a notable example. And when you want to think about what group should be targeted next, Latinos. They have the highest movie-going rate in North America, but Asians are closing in fast. And you know what? Latinos, Asians, they want their own Black Panther. They want their own big-budget movies that reflect them and reflect their world. And when you make it well enough and good enough, everyone's going to show up.
Well, you know, here's something interesting that, Michael, that kind of speaks to what you're mentioning here. And, you know, when you visit these cities that, you know, you're not from and you don't have a car and you're taking Uber everywhere, you meet some very interesting people, Uber drivers, some of whom are journalists, by the way, who
don't make any money.
Exactly. And in fact, editors at the Yakima Herald, and they are the Spanish-speaking or were the Spanish-speaking editor at the Yakima Herald. And I said, well, gee, why does the, you know, Seattle Times have a Spanish language, you know, newspaper in Washington State? And it's because of farm workers who migrate to Yakima, and they have a huge Spanish-speaking population up there. Well, guess what? They can go to films from where, you know, whether they're from Mexico or Chile or Peru, or they can go to films that are made right here in the United States, or wherever they are, as long as they're Spanish language, they will go.
There you go. And the MPAA made news when they announced the record global box office, didn't they? Because they did just talk about the box office.
No, they also started talking about, you know, disc sales, you know, DVD sales and digital copy sales. And they said 88 billion globally, people spent $88 billion. Did they spend $88 billion on movie? Okay, so it's $88 billion on movie tickets, sales and rentals of DVDs and movies and digital copies. That's the headline there.
Yes, so they're finally recognizing we should be touting the entire pie, because movies make so much more money after the box office is over than they ever did before, because of streaming services, because of pay-per-view, because of Netflix subscriptions and Blu-ray purchases and things like that. So it's, you know, the box office is $40 billion worldwide. The whole thing is $88 billion. So that just shows you how powerful the entertainment business is.
Make no mistake, the MPAA is a trade group, okay? And their constituents are studios. So if they weren't mentioning it before, it's because studios didn't want them to. So studios mm-hmm. obviously want them to mention it now. And I would imagine a large reason that the studios didn't want you know, the DVD sales mentioned, and certainly digital sales weren't necessarily a thing until the past 4 years, they didn't want to share in that pie.
Right, but now they have to. They want to tell a better story. With attendance being down to a 23-year low, they want to share some good news. So they say, hey, by the way, we're making lots of money in other areas.
Yes.
And one of those areas is China. And it turns out now, in fact, Avengers Infinity Wars will not open day and date in China. It's going to open day and date in Japan, but it will open 2 weeks later in China. So when you've got these big, huge movies and you want to set worldwide box office records on opening weekend, and you want to make a lot of noise and you want to avoid black markets, you want to line up all your releases at the same time. But it's hard to do. And that did not work out for China.
Well, they're also trying to prevent piracy is another issue.
Well, that's, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so that's why they want to open day and date everywhere. And guess what? Who's the biggest movie market in the world?
Well, right now it's North America, but...
Nope. Right now it's China.
Oh, well, you mean for screens, right? 54,000 screens?
No, I mean for the box office. For the first quarter of 2018, the biggest movie market in the world was China. It grossed $3.17 billion, and that's... total is bigger than the record first quarter of 2017 in North America, which was $3 billion. The U.S. had like $2.89 billion in the first quarter. So it was a couple hundred million dollars bigger. So for the first time in history, in a single quarter, the biggest box office market in the world is not North America, it's China.
You know, I take 1 week off.
Yeah, you missed the big news. Yeah, so that will fall back. China's not going to take the ring for the entire year. It will not be the leader, but it's getting closer and closer every day. And that's why what they do matters. They have 10,000 theater locations. They have 54,000 screens. IMAX just signed a new deal to add 30 more screens into China. And everything they do makes noise.
Well, speaking of China, you know, I've been watching this trade war brewing, and I've been wondering when, and we talked about this, you know, during our last episode, whether movies might be affected by this trade war. But, you know, China's built a lot of movie theaters, and they do not have a lot of homegrown content yet to fill those movie theaters, and they need some content. So far, we haven't heard much rumblings about whether movies might be affected in this trade war with tariffs.
That's right. I mean, the U.S. slapped tariffs on steel and other industries in China. China responded with very smart, targeted tariffs on U.S. products, mostly geared towards agriculture and industries where Trump is popular. So they targeted like the pork industry because pig producers are in the heartland and those people supported Trump. So they're really trying to put the hurt on senators and congressmen in states that went for Trump, which means the movie industry, New York and L.A., that didn't go for Trump. And guess what? They need the movies. They have reasons not to target those states. And so it's all working out okay for Hollywood. So they've got a trade war going on. They're hoping they don't get caught in the crossfire. They're also trying to do a new trade deal with China. They're looking for an end to the official quotas on how many Hollywood movies can be released in China. They want more warnings on the release schedule. Right now, they only find out like a month in advance when their movie is opening. That's not good.
Well, yeah, it's like 5 weeks, although in some cases it's longer than that. Depends. But yeah, most of the time, yeah, it's like 6 weeks.
They want a bigger cut of the box office, of course. Right now they get about 25% of revenue. I had a question, though, and you probably don't know the answer, so I apologize. But in this article talking about the trade deal that they're trying for, they say that the quota is still in place, more movies get released, but the implication was that any movies above the quota level are simply straight deals where they pay a flat fee for the movie and then the Chinese distributor keeps all the money.
Well, here's the reason I don't know the answer to this. It's because nobody wants to tell you, okay? Nobody wants this information out there, whether it's for, you know, films from India, whether it's for films from the United States. Nobody wants the terms of deals in China to be announced. There are reasons for that, both from the China side and from the Hollywood side. But yeah, I couldn't tell you, although that sounds like something that would be true.
So we know that that happened at least for one Indian film. We talked about it 2 weeks ago, where it was just a straight deal where they played a flat fee and then released the movie because it had been out like 5 years earlier and they were sort of taking a gamble. But when we've been talking about, oh, look, the boycott is meaningless. It's over. The quota level is gone. Clearly, a lot more movies are being released than that actual number. We may not have understood that those extra movies being released were only on a different sort of terms. So that's important to know. So that's something that we hadn't caught before. So we said, the quota's over. Obviously, Hollywood's blown past that number. Well, yeah, but if they're having to make poor deals in order to get past it, that's not good for them.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the whole trade issue could not come at a worse time for renegotiating these this import deal for Hollywood.
That's right. And there's some more bad news for China. The New York Times had a major story in the New York Times Magazine about the case of Hong Kong's missing booksellers. We've talked about it a lot here, and we've got a link to their story in our show notes, where China has continued to crack down on the booksellers in Hong Kong, ignored that territory's somewhat independent status, and punished people for publishing books. And that's an important story for the book industry. We wanted to keep an eye on those people that have been, you know, thrown into a jail somewhere by the government, which they refuse to acknowledge. So it's good to keep a spotlight on that story as well.
Well, there's also a, there was a story in the New York Times about the newspapers in Hong Kong, the South China Morning Post. Actually, no, I take that back. That you know, only one was from Hong Kong, and it was about how whether they had freedom of press in Hong Kong or not.
Well, they don't. No,
yeah,
it's they have a very limited freedom of the press.
Correct. Yeah. But you know what? I wonder if services and subscription services, you know, we have them for Netflix, whether services like MoviePass will help lift attendance here in the U.S.
It will, as long as they're willing to lose money left and right. But God bless MoviePass. They make news every single week.
Yes, you're telling me. I mean, literally, they will do just about anything. I've always said, Michael, this is a marketing play. They're going to, you know, make this huge explosion of attention. They want all of the attention on them. And then they're either going to go public or sell off or try and do something to you know, get enough attention on them that the owners can get out. And sure enough, they lifted their blackout of popular AMC locations. I guess they had like 10 to 15 theaters out there where they said AMC, you know, MoviePass can't be used at these theaters, and it ticked
right.
Everybody.
We think they were trying to save money. They said they were trying to make a point. If they were trying to make a point, they didn't do a very good job of it, because they didn't release any info or share any information about what happened when they blocked one theater and did people rush to another one. But you're in LA, that's where most of the locations were, and now you can go to those locations, can't you?
Yeah, and I guess what they're saying is that MoviePass accounts for $2 million per week of revenue at the box office for AMC locations, and they were doing their own test to see whether people would be diverted to other theaters.
That's what they claim.
Yes.
Yeah.
They also decided to buy a business that I don't think anybody even knew existed anymore, which was MoviePhone. This was back in the late 80s and throughout the 90s, you could actually, you know, buy movie tickets or find out movie times right on your phone.
It was very exciting before the era of the smartphone. I used it. A lot of people did. And its time has passed. But nonetheless, they acquired it. I'm not quite sure what they think the play is there. It just seems like their deal to like buy a movie at a festival and then release it. It's like, that doesn't make any long-term strategic sense.
Yeah, I don't know what the play is here. I cannot figure it out. Although I'm hoping to meet with them at CinemaCon.
Yeah, maybe they'll reboot MoviePhone and make it, important in the new era in some way, shape, or form.
Wait a second. Did you say reboot? Because if then it must be time for our reboot, sequels, and spinoff segment.
There are so many stories we could have covered, but the one we'll mention is Hidden Figures, the hit popular history book turned into a hit feature film, is now going to become a hit, they hope, TV series. Hidden Figures, about women, black women working at NASA and helping with mathematics, became hugely popular. Now they're going to turn it into an ongoing TV show. It's going to be carried by the National Geographic Channel.
Yeah, now I don't know whether this is going to be kind of a documentary series or I guess
not. No, it's going to fictional. It's a fictional, you know, just an ongoing life working at NASA. You're a female black mathematician trying to, you know, make your day, you know.
I mean, I don't know. What's the struggle of each episode is, oh, this math problem is hard.
Well, it's hard being a black woman working in NASA. That's the story.
Okay, fine. Well, it was hard for Spotify, actually, trying to make a go of it. That's
right. They finally went public.
Yes. And I guess they did it in a very, I don't want to say odd way, but they did a direct IPO. They did not go to a bank and have the bank underwrite it and, you know, go out to investors. They said, nope, we're just going to bring our shares directly to the stock exchange.
That's right. And it was the biggest direct IPO in history. At the end of the day, they were valued at $26 billion at the close of day of business when they first went public. We'll have to see how that holds up over time. But Wall Street likes Spotify. And why do they like it? Well, they say as the company gets bigger, it's negotiating better terms with record labels. They were focused on the fact that their gross profit margin was 14% in 2016, and it was 21% in 2017. The gross profit margin is the percent it gets to keep after all its direct costs are taken care of, meaning like paying out to the labels all the money that they owe them. So with the new terms that they negotiated, they were able to increase their gross profit margin by 50% from 1 year to the next, and they think that trend is going to continue.
Yeah, and the way they look at it is, you know, they've always said, look, we hope to get to 25 to 30%, where, you know, 75% goes to the labels, and congratulations, labels, here's all your money. And, you know, we'll make a, you know, comfortable living at 25 to 30%. Of course, we have some costs associated with that, operating costs, and, you know, we have to pay people and for technology, et cetera. So it'll eat into that a little bit. So that's why you're down at 21%. But that's right, you know, they're headed in the right direction, I guess.
You make them sound so begrudging. Fine, here's your money, labels, take your money. It's like, it is their music.
Yeah, no, yeah, like, true.
There is no
true.
Business without their music.
I say that because originally, if you recall, the record labels were fighting Spotify.
As well they should.
Well, here's the thing.
They don't necessarily think Spotify is a good deal. Artists don't necessarily think it's a good deal yet. They're not getting the money that they feel they deserve.
Well, think about it this way, okay? To do these deals, Spotify cut deals with the three biggest record labels, okay? Sony Music, they have a 5.7% stake, which is worth $1.5 billion. Universal Music Group had a 4% stake worth about $1 billion. Warner Music Group also had a 4% stake worth about $1 billion. And shortly after the direct IPO, Sony Music sold $250 million worth of stock. Now, how much of that is going to the artists?
Right, exactly. There's two things here. Once the record labels are making money off Spotify, but it's in a separate pie that their artists are not getting a cut of. And even worse, if they have a stake in Spotify, they now have a reason. You know how you have a TV network or a studio that produces a hit TV show, and then they sell syndication rights to their own cable channel, and they give themselves really favorable terms that screw over the creators of the show and the people who deserve income because they're selling it to themselves. Well, that's sort of that self-dealing is happening here. The labels now have a reason to negotiate better terms for Spotify rather than better terms for the labels, because they make money off Spotify being successful, but the artists do not take part in that success.
Yeah, and we've said that for I don't even know how many years.
Yeah, so the artists really, you know, they say, oh, how much money did you make off Spotify? That's awesome. What's my cut? Because they're not getting it.
Yeah, well, more and more people will be signing up for these services, whether it's Apple Music or Spotify. I don't know about Deezer, okay, but maybe Amazon Music. Actually, Amazon Music might grow because of smart speakers, and whether it's Echo or the HomePod from Apple or the Google Home. What people are finding in this new report out, I can't remember it, Music Ally is the publisher of this report. They said, look, people who have smart speakers in their home are far more likely to have a premium music service. 48% of those with smart speakers have a premium music service.
Playing music is the killer app. Well, after you've asked for the weather, you know, five times a day, and what time is it, and set an alarm or set a timer, people realize what they really want to do is play music on it. It's a really quick and easy way to access that digital music that you sort of don't have in the home. You have to have your computer hooked up to speakers, blah, 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 blah. Now with the smart speaker, it's really easy to do. And if you didn't have a streaming service or some access to a digital library, you're buying one. And so that's what they're finding out, that now access to your smart speaker and creating music playlists for them and getting new music to them is a really important player in the music industry. There's a lot of growth in people listening to music in their home. They don't have to put on CDs or LPs anymore. They just say, hey, look, you know, I won't say her name, that woman, that lady, play me a song, you know.
Well, they also are beginning to say, hey, look, you know, what's going to be really important is metadata and creating these playlists, these automated playlists.
Well, no, and that's hugely important for recompensing the songwriters and the artists. The metadata is there for access for the labels to track payments. It's important for fans who want to say, oh, I like this kind of music. I want some other music like that. So there's a lot of work to do to create more robust metadata that can be used via smart speakers. That's absolutely true.
Well, Michael, you're a Spotify member. I mean, so are you happy with the service?
Well, I don't have a smart speaker, but yes, I am. It's a whole new way of thinking of it. It's awkward for me not owning the music. I don't know. I'm worried it will all disappear tomorrow, but yes.
And, you know, one thing that some of these pure play services like Pandora are worried about is that these smart speakers will actually become gateways. If you want to get on them, you'll have to pay.
I'm not sure what you mean.
Well, you know, if everybody's listening to their music through smart speakers, and of course it's killing radio, by the way, because people are just saying, you know what, play me X, or play me, you know, I'm in the mood for classical music, or whatever, and nobody's turning on and saying, you know what, play me KEXP. Nobody's doing that anymore. So they're saying, look, you know, nobody's, if everybody's listening to their music through these smart speakers, and we need to be on those smart speakers, will those smart speakers become the people who own them, whether it's Apple or Amazon or Google, become gatekeepers and ask for recompense to be put on there?
Okay, I doubt it because, you know, the limiting the access to what you have seems crazy. But no, my mom says play BBC and okay. Plays the radio. People play NPR shows. I don't think it's a radio killer. I think if anything, it's bringing radio back into the home, perhaps where most of radio happens out on the world. And when you're traveling in a car or other things, I think that's where a lot of radio airplay still happens. Radio is still very robust. But in the home, I think it may actually make radio shows and podcasts and things a little more present than it was before.
We have to figure out a way to get on that, the Echo from Amazon. We have to figure out.
Hey, if you're at Echo and you want to help us get our podcast onto it, call us.
Yes, 888-567-SAND. But in the meantime, you know what, Michael? Every week you actually pick a book for us to read, okay? And you'll find out what book I'm reading a little bit later on in this episode. But every week you go through all the new releases over at bookfilter.com and you find a few of the books that are out there. I mean, there's thousands of books published each week, but you find a few for us to be reading or that might be ready for a movie or a TV show. What have you got for us this week?
This week, it's just a book that's good for business. It's called Factfulness, and Bill Gates said it's the most important book he's ever read. My God, that's a big claim. It's by the Swedish scientist, analysis, I'm not sure what he is, Hans Rosling, and his son and daughter-in-law, Anna Rosling and Ola Rosling. He's a big phenomenon. You've probably seen him on TED Talks. He's been seen tens of millions of times. He's been going around the world spreading the good news about the progress that we're making, wanting people to understand where we are in terms of world poverty and vaccination and electricity rates, because most people think the world is far worse off than it actually is. And he's not doing this to say, hey, don't worry about it, everything's fine. But he's saying when we're tackling these big problems like climate change and extreme poverty, it's good to know what's actually working so that we can continue to do that and progress further. So he's written this new book called Factfulness and has a fun 13 question quiz at the very beginning, which he has given all over the world at Davos and to journalists and to people specializing in fighting poverty and college students, all sorts of incredibly smart, informed, educated people, and they all do terrible on it. It says things like, how much of the world has access to electricity? 30%, 50%, or 80%?
And everybody goes, a game show here. I think this could be a game show.
Absolutely. And the answer is 80%. How many children have received a vaccination? Children who are 1 year or younger all around the world, how many have received a vaccination of some sort? It turns out to be 80%, a lot higher than people think. Extreme poverty. How much of that in the last 20 years? Has it doubled? Has it about the same? Or has it been cut in half? And the truth is that it's been cut in half. And there's a lot of reasons for all of this. But he wants to spread the good news and he wants people to know what's working because there are things we should continue to do. And he also wants to help improve critical thinking. And he talks about different ways to deal with the news and the media and numbers that come at you in every way, shape, or form. And I was very proud. We do this on the show all the time. They say, oh, the box office is down from last quarter. We're like, okay, but where is that rank all time? Like, what about the last 20 years? Put it into context, keep it in perspective. And that's what we try to do. We say, well, yeah, it's down from last quarter, but the last quarter was the highest first quarter in box office history. So that's not actually terribly bad news. How does it stand historically? Quite well. It's the third highest quarter in history, you know, that sort of thing. So we do that on the show, not to pat ourselves on the back too much, but he gives a lot of easy tips and ways to think about numbers and facts and the news that comes at you all the time, why the news is always so negative, why you should keep it in perspective, and the really positive story of things that are changing around the world that have really important things. One thing that is important to the industry in Hollywood is the massive growth in Asia and Africa. Africa is not a country mired in poverty that will forever be corrupt and awful. There's a lot of countries with a lot of good stories, and Africa is poised for tremendous growth. And if you want to make money, you really should be looking at Africa and Asia. That's where the world's population is going to be in the next 20 years.
You know, when I was in Seattle, everybody kept saying, you got to go to the Discovery Center, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation Discovery Center. I went, and it's all about their work. It was the most depressing museum. I was like, why are people telling me to go to this? It's all about everybody's dying of malaria. And I mean, it's great that they're doing all of the amazing work they're doing, but it's just, you know, one abysmal problem after another. You're like, I can't solve all this.
Well, that's why this book could be helpful to you. So, you know, it's not to ignore the problems that we face, but to say, hey, we're making a lot of progress. Things can get better. Let's focus on what's working and not get mired in negativity and think, when you throw up your hands and say, oh my God, the world's so miserable, so many starving people, what can I do? Well, actually, there's a lot you can do and it can have a big impact.
Well, some progress has been made in, you know, over the past 6 to 8 months in, you know, diversity and sexual misconduct, which brings us to our sexual misconduct palooza, which again, we're not making light of it.
Sorry, you don't need to apologize every time for the name. You can change the name or stop apologizing.
Well, I think we need to change the name.
Well, go right ahead. Come up with something better.
Well, contact us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com, if you have an idea for what we should call this segment of our show. But this week, actually, we're talking, you know, some good news, maybe. Academy head John Bailey, he was cleared by an internal investigation by the Academy of a sole sexual misconduct allegation.
Yes, I don't know how independent it was. We assume it was independent. I don't know whether it's a completely outside firm or what, whether some people will say, oh, he's cleared himself. We don't know the details. We don't know what was going on. No other accusations have sprung up. So that certainly is a good thing in terms of whether you believe John Bailey. You know, it's an awkward thing when you have to clear the head of your entire corporation
but
or business.
But it just goes to show you how, like, the second a finger gets pointed, even if due process takes place, there's always that niggling little question about whether it was accurate or not.
Well, it's not due process in terms of, you know, an internal investigation by a place that you head. That's not due process is when you have a law and you go to the courts.
Well,
and this did not rise, I think, to a legal standing necessarily. So, I mean, you know.
Now, what's going on at the Swedish Academy? We just talked about the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Science, AMPAS. The Swedish Academy that awards the Nobel Prize in Literature has been, I guess there's some sexual misconduct allegations over there.
That's right. Three members of the board that oversees the Nobel Prize in Literature have quit. A fourth member is considering because of the scandal involving sexual misconduct and misappropriation of funds. It's a big, ugly scandal. The king has weighed in. It's a crisis because they're not going to be able to reach a quorum if enough people quit. And you're on that board for life, so they can't replace them until they die, apparently. So they're going to change those rules. Whether anything will happen, we don't know, but you know, it's everywhere, basically, is what we're saying. It's even at Nickelodeon. Now, this is not necessarily a sexual misconduct story, but Nickelodeon has ended their relationship with Dan Schneider, who is a kid TV powerhouse. He has overseen so many hits at Nickelodeon, so many stars that he's helped create. He has their number one show right now called Henry Danger, and they have broken off with him, and no one has said a word of why, except at the end of a Hollywood Reporter story, I think, they said, oh yeah, some people say he may have a foot fetish, but other people say, no, he doesn't really have a foot fetish, not that I know of. You're like, okay. You can't help but think, what on God's green earth, what reason could they have for breaking off with Dan Schneider, except something that is a problem? And of course, these days, we immediately think sexual misconduct. Not fair to Dan Schneider, but not a word as to why they have dumped their relationship with their number one producer. And I don't mean like currently, of all time. So this is a big story. We don't know what's going on yet. And we certainly want to find out why have they broken off with Dan Schneider? He should speak up. Let us know. They should speak up. Somebody should talk.
Well, if Dan Schneider no longer being at Nickelodeon is a big story, I wonder what you'll think of some of our stories in Big Deal or Big Whoop. Big Deal or Big Whoop is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, you know, Netflix thinks streaming is way cooler than going to the movies, but it also thinks movie festivals are pretty damn cool too. Last year, the Cannes Film Festival responded to criticism by saying that all films in competition must book a theatrical release in France. We love movies, and movies should be seen in movie theaters, they said. The only problem is that France has some onerous regulations that state if you release a film in theaters, you must wait ages before putting it on a streaming service. It's called the chronology of media. Now Netflix is crying foul. They say if our films can't compete at Cannes, we won't go. So there. Cannes' response? A Gaelic shrug of the shoulders. Whatever. Among the Netflix films that were poised to go to Cannes were Paul Greengrass's new film Norway and the first screening of the long-lost Orson Welles film The Other Side of the Wind. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop. Why would Netflix care if they weren't in competition? There's lots of other categories. Out of competition, they say, is not as prestigious. That's absurd. Han Solo is debuting out of competition at Cannes. The Orson Welles film The Other Side of the Wind. What better place? That wouldn't be in competition, I assume. So you'd be taking that to a special Cannes Classics section or whatever. But to me, you get a lot of great publicity and you don't even have the bother of, losing out on a top prize. So it just seems a win-win for me. If you like the platform of Cannes, a lot of people use it even without being in competition. Most films at Cannes are not in competition. So I think they're just being foolish.
I would agree with you. Now, whatever amount of money NBC has been dangling in front of the cast of Friends, it just got doubled. Why? Well, the premiere of Roseanne's revival on ABC reached a massive 18 million viewers on overnights alone. With time shifting, Roseanne hits 25 million viewers and ABC renewed it for 13 episodes in season 2. Episode 3 held well. Episode 3? Are they up to episode 3 already? I guess they are.
Yes, they are. Yeah, they had 2 in the first week.
Oh, okay. Well, it reached more than 20 million viewers. That's huge. Apparently, supporting Trump can pay off, at least for star Roseanne Barr. Apparently, can't work for him for it to pay off. In comparison, NBC has been thrilled with the 10 million viewer reach of Will and Grace. So if you're sick of all these revivals of classic sitcoms with their original casts, tough. They're just getting started. Stop watching them then. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. They're going to keep doing more of them. This was the biggest overnight for a sitcom since a Big Bang Theory season debut 4 years earlier. More people watched Roseanne than watched the Academy Awards, I think, in North America. So they're just going to keep going.
Now, wait a second. I see here the CW renewed 10 shows. Stars of both Crazy Ex-Girlfriend and Jane the Virgin were preemptively told that they were renewed for a final season.
No, they told the world. So the shows were renewed, and both the star of Jane the Virgin and the creator, Rachel Bloom of The Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, said, "We've been renewed for our final season." They took it upon themselves to say, yeah, the next season will be our last.
But like Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, they'd only have 3 seasons. Or maybe four.
They've been renewed for their fourth and final season. The fourth season, and she said that will be our final season.
I guess maybe she's just tired of doing it.
No, I think it's just, it's just they've run its course. You know, it's got a very particular story and it wouldn't make any sense to go farther than it has. It's certainly run its course creatively. They did a big change this season where she's actually mentally ill and needs help. So she is crazy. She does need mental help. But, they're just saying, hey, we've run our course and we're done. They're sort of taking control of the storyline. Okay. It was interesting that they did it rather than the CW.
True. Saudi Arabia is open for business. Show business, that is. The Middle Eastern country led by newly in power Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is eager to expand into entertainment. AMC, the movie theater chain, will be opening cinemas there, with other chains to follow. Black Panther became the first film to screen publicly after a 35-year ban on movie going was ended, and much more is on the way. Plans for movie studios and other content creation is moving ahead, and everyone from Cirque du Soleil to Disney on Ice to National Geographic's theme park like Ocean Odyssey, they're all rushing to provide entertainment and reap the gold, black gold, that is, for their troubles. Big deal or big whoop?
Oh, it's a big deal, Hollywood. Just make sure you don't send any Jews, women, or gays.
Now, here's the thing. Black Panther will not be the first film to screen. It will be the first film to be booked into a movie theater that is an actual standing movie theater. The Emoji Movie was the first movie to screen, although it was just screened, at a theater. It wasn't a movie theater.
Got it.
Okay. Yeah. Qualifiers for that. Now, we're not sure whether to spin this story as the rise of Netflix or the bungling of ABC. That network lost producing giant Shonda Rhimes to Netflix, and now the same may be happening with its sitcom heavyweight, Kenya Barris. He's the creator of Black-ish, the biggest ABC sitcom since Modern Family. A recent episode found the network butting heads with Harris when they couldn't agree on how to handle some touchy political issues. In other words, they wouldn't let Harris do what he wanted and pulled the episode instead. That was the final straw, and now Harris wants to get out of his newly signed deal and head to Netflix. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a very big deal. I mean, I think this is a story of them simply not supporting a talent that has bursting with ideas. I mean, they finally greenlit a spinoff of Black-ish. They put it on Freeform. They said it wasn't adult enough. It's called Grown-ish, and it's done great. They said no to his Toni Collette drama about a woman working at the CIA. They said no to a sitcom starring couples on both sides of the political divide. The Alex Baldwin vehicle collapsed. NBC picks up a show of his. It feels like everyone but ABC wants to be in the business with Kenya Barris. So eventually, I think he just said, you guys don't seem to want to work with me, so I'm going to go elsewhere. And the idea that they could not come to terms and let him craft the episode the way he wanted, what could he possibly have said in the episode that was so touchy? ABC said, we won't air it. I mean, that's just bonkers. You have a discussion, you have a thing, but for God's sakes, you have to give the guy his reins and let him do what he wants creatively within obviously certain parameters. But I can't imagine what he wanted to do that they felt they'd just yank the episode. What an insult to your top creator. I think it's a disaster for ABC.
I think that they're trying to create the lost episodes, the search for the lost episode. It'll become like, when it finally airs, it'll be a ratings bonanza.
Yeah.
Well, while ABC's feud with Harris continues, the courts may have ended one between Olivia de Havilland. She sued the network FX and everyone involved in the miniseries feud, saying the filmmakers failed to obtain rights to her life story and portrayed her as a malicious gossip when the 101-year-old star of Gone with the Wind has gone to great lengths to present a wholesome public image. They also criticized one of the members of the three-panel judges, namely Justice Egerton, who previously worked at NBC and once worked at a firm that repped FX. The judge said, tough. People do not own history, whether they're legendary actors or nobodies. Filmmakers can portray Judge Lance Ito in The People vs. O.J. Simpson, the cop in Fruitvale Station, politician Sarah Palin in Game Change, and so on. De Havilland's lawyers say they will appeal and can only hope the next judge is a fan of Turner Classic Movies. Big deal or big whoop?
I guess it's a big whoop until the final appeal is exhausted. They certainly make a good case about, there's lots of public figures. You don't get to control what is said about you. Though it's a little confusing when you're a famous star and people will pay for the rights to your life and they show you doing things you say you never did.
And I'm sure we kind of joked around about this before, about whether people even knew Olivia de Havilland was still alive.
Right, exactly.
Maybe Pete Townsend could sue himself, actually. The rocker famously suffers from hearing loss, and now a ruling may give other musicians some hope. A musician rehearsing at the Royal Opera House in London was blasted out of his seat by the brass section during work on Wagner's Der Walküre. The noise level exceeded 130 decibels. The viola player suffered acoustic shock and irreversible hearing loss, which ended his career in 2012 and made it impossible for him to perform daily tasks like prepping food for cooking or listening to his son, an acclaimed French horn player. The Royal Opera House said there is no such thing as acoustic shock, and the musician actually developed a rare illness known as Meniere's disease the same afternoon as that rehearsal. The court said that this was nonsense, and artistic endeavors must follow the same rules for safety as factory or any other work setting. Big deal or big whoop?
I think this is a big deal. It just should have a lot of practical effects about making sure people wear, you know, things that they can and just say, look, we got to deal with this. You know, yeah, you're going to be really noisy and we need to be able to hear in order to collaborate, but we need to protect their hearing at the same time. Come up with a solution.
You know, I know a couple of musicians who play in orchestras, and they're all string players, except for one who is a flute player, and actually, no, some are horn players. But they all say that if you're sitting in front of the horns, you are wearing earplugs.
Yeah, and so maybe they need to make sure that everybody has to wear earplugs, or whatever needs to be done has to be done.
Yeah, and I don't know about Meniere's disease, whether it can come on suddenly like that all at once.
Yeah.
Okay, the hottest trend in TV has been renewing a show after its first episode airs, and then renewing it before its first episode airs, and now renewing a show for two seasons rather than one. Okay, so that's the order of, you know, hipness in renewal. Well, no one is going to top Amazon anytime soon. That company made a massive play for the rights to spin-off TV shows set in the fantasy universe of J.R.R. Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings. This huge deal included all sorts of complicated details. One person said it's the most complicated deal they've ever seen, and likely the most complicated rights deal in history. Well, we don't know if Peter Jackson will be involved hands-on with the show, but here's one little fact. Amazon may have committed up to $1 billion because they guaranteed, get this, a five-season commitment. No word on whether there's an episode count, but five seasons is five seasons and pretty darn jaw-dropping. So if you ever wondered what took place between The Hobbit and The Fellowship of the Ring, or after The Lord of the Rings, or during The Lord of the Rings back at the Shire, well, you're about to find out. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop. This is such a unique property and a unique deal. I don't think it's the wave of the future.
You know, speaking of unique deals, Amazon is into so many things. When I was in Seattle, I went to the Amazon Go store. Have you heard about this store where you kind of just...
Oh, yeah.
You go in and then you kind of stand around going, I don't really need anything in here. You scan an app on your phone when you're walking into the store, and then it tracks you around the store. And as you pick things off the shelf, it puts them in your virtual basket, and then you just walk out without paying for it. Of course, you know, your app is attached to your Amazon account, which is attached to your credit card. And so, you know, you kind of see a whole bunch of people go into the Amazon Go store, and you know, you just
it's like a convenience store where they just sort of seen what it's like, of course, but it's like a convenience store where you don't have to go to a cashier and pay.
Right. And it actually got something wrong on my order.
Oh, how fascinating. But you know, I do this every day at drugstores and grocery stores. It's just that I check myself out instead of having a system do it. I'm just scanning the things myself and putting it in my bag myself. So I never see any employees. I never deal with anyone. They're just making it that step easier. So I don't think this is very far-fetched. Supermarkets say you can do it in a small space, but it's going to be a lot harder to do it in a big grocery store with lots of more items. So maybe that's a level of trickiness that they won't be able to get beyond quite soon. But, you know, it's what they're doing in general, right? You know, get rid of the cashiers, get rid of the bag boys. You just do it all yourself.
Yeah, you know, I thought you were headed in a completely different direction there with that statement when you started. You know, I just do it, I just walk out without paying. Now, if you're a British writer, you can't win the Pulitzer Prize or the National Book Award. But if you're an American writer, you can win the UK's top literary prize, the Booker. And for the last 2 years, Americans have done just that, namely Paul Beatty for The Sellout and George Saunders for Lincoln and the Bardo, a book I still am struggling to finish. That's the book I'm reading right now, and it's been like months. I gotta finish this book. Now, UK authors are asking the Booker to rethink its rule change and make the Booker open to just UK and Commonwealth members, the remit that gave the prestigious prize its unique flavor. This view comes courtesy of the Folio Society, a group of authors that was so upset with the direction of the Booker even before that rule change that it founded its own awards. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop slash big deal because I can't make up my mind. I'm so sympathetic to all the arguments. The people who say it's lost its particular flavor, I understand, though I think 2 years is not enough time to get a real good sample size. Let's see what it looks like after 10 years. To other people who say, really? Do we want to have an award based on the colonial empire of the UK? Is that something to celebrate, the fact that they occupied India for, you know, all those years? I empathize with that. I like the idea of saying, hey, let's just have an award for the English language rather than based on certain territories. That makes sense to me. But I do think in general, give it a few more years and see where it's at. Don't rush judgment into changing the rules yet again.
You know, since our podcast began, we've talked about Broadway grosses and the Million Dollar Club, those shows popular enough to gross more than $1 million during a regular week of shows. Well, thanks to rising ticket prices, we have to change that to the $2 Million Club. Soon we'll have about six shows regularly hitting $2 million a week. Hamilton can often hit $3 million, but you can consistently count on it and The Lion King, Wicked, Aladdin, and Frozen to hit $2 million. And yes, a number of those shows are Disney shows. By the way, Frozen set a new house record at the St. James by grossing $2.2 million, bursting past the $1.6 million record held by the producers back in 2004, a distant era when $1.6 million seemed like a lot of money. Harry Potter will join the $2 million club when it hits eight shows a week. And Springsteen, by the way, regularly hits around $1.9 million with just five performances a week. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal because ticket prices are through the roof on Broadway, and this is just one more example of it. Frozen is not that popular that it should be beating out the producers, but they've raised ticket prices so much, they are handily beating the producers. It's just, you know, it's out of control. Broadway is becoming just impossible for anyone to go to.
Yeah, you know, Tony Kushner, I was reading an interview with him, and he's the playwright, of course, of Angels in America, among others. And he was, you know, of course, Angels in America is being revived on Broadway. And he said that he's been told that people can get tickets to it. If they try hard enough, they won't have to pay, you know, a fortune and you know, give up their firstborn. But even he kind of knew, like, geez, you know, Broadway is a completely different place now than it was 25 years ago when Angels in America was first on Broadway.
That's true. And Angels in America is doing well. I saw it. It got rave reviews. I was one of the people who did not love it as much as everyone else. But that show is not the phenomenon that, you know, say Hamilton was. Now, the original production was a massive phenomenon, but Angels is pretty well discounted. It's grossing like 68% of its gross. So it's almost sold out, great reviews, but you're not paying full price. So the average ticket price is just under $100. So that's a show that's well within your reach. But something like, you know, Hamilton or The Lion King or Frozen and Aladdin and Springsteen, those are where you're getting screwed.
Well, Springsteen, $750 for the best tickets, face value. I mean, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. It's the reason I did not go, as a matter of fact.
Exactly. It wasn't going to be any fun. And speaking of ticket prices for seeing a concert, that brings us to Inside Baseball, doesn't it?
That's right. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And last week, when the New York Times published an article, the headline of which was Live Nation Rules Music Ticketing, Some Say With Threats. Everybody definitely honed in on this, and there were lots of spin-off stories. But how do you want to handle this, Michael? I mean, this is...
Well, I think this is a pat on the back for us, right? This is a pretty obvious story. We weren't the only ones. But what happened years ago?
Years ago, when Live Nation, which was a concert promoter and they owned venues, that was already two out of the three silos that make up the live concert industry. You have, you know, owning the venue, you know, you rent the venue out, you rent the venue out to promoters who pay for the show, and then managers book that show. So the management of talent, so you might manage, say, Bruce Springsteen. If you're John Landau, you manage Bruce Springsteen, and you then go to promoters and you say, hey, will you, you know, pay money to have Bruce Springsteen play Madison Square Garden, and the promoter pays Madison Square Garden and eventually makes their money back through ticket sales. Well, There are those three silos. Live Nation owned two of them, and then went to get the ticketing. That was
right. So now they control the acts, the venues, and the ticketing.
Right,
but they don't control all acts. But they're basically a monopoly, or as close to it. And there's suggestions of antitrust accusations. The Department of Justice is looking into these accusations against Live Nation. A report claims, and when you control too much of the business, you're going to abuse your power. And that's what people are claiming is happening right now. And of course, we've talked about the stories where, like, if you don't book this venue in London, you can't book this venue in New York.
That was Ozzy Osbourne a couple of weeks ago suing suing AEG, who is, Ticketmaster's competitor, Live Nation's competitor. And we said back in 2009, when this merger and acquisition was, you know, undergoing, we said, look, this is a very bad idea, okay? Because eventually, Live Nation's strength and power will be, you know, they'll overplay their hand. And that's exactly what's happening here. AEG says, hey, the only reason we did the whole Staples Center in LA and O2 Arena in London thing is because Live Nation was doing it between Madison Square Garden and the Forum. You know, they weren't booking their talent at the Staples Center. And they said, look, if you don't play the Forum, you can't play Madison Square Garden. So we were just doing the same thing. AEG has all of these emails, apparently, that kind of show, that Ticketmaster, which is owned by Live Nation, is saying, look, that Live Nation is saying, if you don't use Ticketmaster as the ticketing, if you don't contract with them, we're not going to play your venue.
So ticket prices are at an all-time high, even if adjusting for inflation. Service fees are far from reduced. And Ticketmaster, part of the Live Nation empire, controls 80 of the top 100 arenas in the country. No other company has more than a handful. How are they going to solve this? Other than breaking them up, I don't see how they could.
Yeah, I mean, part of the problem is that when this merger was allowed to happen, all the three things that you just mentioned, we were told there'd be more competition. There's not. We were told ticket prices would kind of settle out. It hasn't. That service fees would go down. They haven't. So it's much more difficult after the fact to prove antitrust than it is to prevent antitrust, because you have to enforce antitrust. And the consent agreement that allowed Live Nation to purchase Ticketmaster and for those two companies to merge ends in 2020. So, you know, after that time period, they can be as antitrusty as they want. Granted, not really, but still, right now, they're not really supposed to be saying, look, if you don't, sign that long-term contract with Ticketmaster, you know, we might just bypass your arena when we come through town with U2. It's the only way to really handle this, you're right, Michael, is probably to break them up.
That's right. And will this Justice Department do that? I doubt it, but we'll have to see.
Think about it. I mean, really, when you think about it, you have the managers, okay, the people who are selling talent to promoters, selling the talent to themselves. That's really what you've got going on here. And in the music industry and in the film industry, that was not allowed. An agency, a talent agency like Creative Artists or ICM, cannot also produce films,
but they do,
or TV shows. No,
don't they?
Management companies do, not agencies. And there is a reason for that. MCA, remember MCA Universal? The A in MCA was agency. Okay. And Lou Wasserman had to make a decision at a point after the Justice Department came to him and said, hey, you can either be the agent or you can be the producer. What's it going to be? He chose producer, and that's how MCA Universal.
But I thought CAA and all those did do produce stuff and oversee stuff and package. You know, I thought they were blurring the lines.
They package.
No, I know they package, but I thought they were also blurring the lines, getting credits. Wasn't the WGA complaining about this?
With managers, yes, that is a problem with managers.
Well, I think the idea of competition in concert going is dead as long as you have these monopolies or these huge companies dominating the market.
Oh, wait a second. I think you're trying to tell us it's time for our obituary section. And unfortunately, this week, we are going to be talking about Stephen Bochco. Not that, I'd love to talk about Stephen Bochco, but unfortunately, he passed away at the age of 74.
Yeah, he was fighting leukemia. I could talk for an hour about Stephen Bochco. No TV show is more important to me than Hill Street Blues. It was a defining moment in my childhood. Seeing that show and the impact it had on me, it was like Citizen Kane for movies, Sergeant Pepper for the Beatles. It's not the greatest show of all time anymore, like it was for me for many years, but its impact is huge, and no one can match that because you have to go back in time. A major show, but he's a 10-time Emmy winner. He's four big hits, Hill Street Blues, L.A. Law, NYPD Blue, and to a slightly lesser degree, Doogie Howser, M.D. Other important shows like Murder, One, which had a season-long arc and kind of inspired the anthology series and all these shows that are in cable and streaming that we have today. Lots of shows that didn't work, like Bay City Blues about a minor league baseball team and Cop Rock, that infamous show. Basically, Stephen Bochco completely rewrote the rules of television with his creative partners and all the people who worked with him. There's before Hill Street Blues and there's after Hill Street Blues, and that's going to be true for the rest of TV history.
Well, and there was before this episode, and now there's after this episode of Showbiz Sandbox, because that wraps up this episode of Showbiz Sandbox. Do you see what I did there?
I did.
Okay, well, you know, you can subscribe to our show so you don't ever miss an episode in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher. You can rate and review the show in those podcast aggregators. It helps other people find the shows. It helps us out. Again, iTunes, Google Play Store, Mike. And you know what? Just anywhere you get your podcasts, you should be able to find us. And if you can't, please do write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com, and let us know. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @ShowbizSandbox, or like us on Facebook, facebook.com/ShowbizSandbox. All of that information is on our website, ShowbizSandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all the stories we've discussed on today's episode, ShowbizSandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT, who will not be at Coachella this year. They can be found on their website, who is mgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's becarefuloutthere.com.
I have no idea what that...
Hill Street Blues.
That's right. Very good. That was the beginning of every episode. That's right. I forgot about that. Well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Of course, don't forget to check out bookfilter.com to know what you should be reading after you finish Lincoln in the Bardo. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.